Srila Prabhupada ki, a person fully aware of religious principles should never offer anything like meat, eggs, or fish in the Shraddha ceremony. And even if one is a Kshatriya, he himself should not eat such things. When suitable food prepared with ghee is offered to saintly persons, the function is pleasing to the forefathers and the Supreme Lord, who are never pleased when animals are killed in the name of sacrifice. Text number 8. Naitadrishya paro dharmo nrinam saddharmam ichyatam nyaso dandasya bhuteshu manu bak kayajasya ya. Translation. Persons who want to advance in superior religion are advised to give up all envy of other living entities, whether in relationship to the body, words, or mind. There is no religion superior to this. Text number 9. Eke karma mayan yagyan jani no yagya vitama atma samyamane niha juvati jnana dipite. Translation. Because of an awakening of spiritual knowledge, those who are intelligent in regard to sacrifice, who are actually aware of religious principles, and who are free from material desires, control the self in the fire of spiritual knowledge or knowledge of the absolute truth. They may give up the process of ritualistic ceremonies. Purport. People are generally very much interested in the karma kanda ritualistic ceremonies for elevation to the higher planetary systems. But when one awakens his spiritual knowledge, he becomes uninterested in such elevation and engages himself fully in jnana yagya to find the objective of life. The objective of life is to stop completely the miseries of birth and death and to return home back to Godhead. When one cultivates knowledge for this purpose, he is considered to be on a higher platform than one who is engaged in karma yagya or fruitive activities. Mukam karoti bachalam bhangam langayate grim yat kripadnam mande shri gurun dinatadanam. So, the Vedic science of logic is called Anvikshi. That is mentioned in another verse in Srimad Bhagavatam. So, logic simply means the plan behind something. So, there is a plan behind this Vedic literature. Of course, the Vedic literature is very vast. It covers all the areas of human concern. That means that even today, actually, in our modern culture, everything that is there that human beings are doing is... there is a background of knowledge meant for that, and that is given in the Vedic literature. The only problem with today's civilization is that people are acting in ignorance. It's not that civilization has to be, the content of civilization has to somehow be changed. What, in general, people are doing. That's always going to be there, that people will work in different occupations and make money, and they will have homes, and they will pay taxes, and they will raise families, etc., 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 etc. And there will be universities and so on and so forth. Government and administration. That is all necessary in human society to have fully developed human life. But there is a background to all of that. Veda does not mean, many people think that the Vedic scriptures are some kind of particular, what is called canon. That means a particular collection of books that belong to one particular sect, the Hindus. And then in the Christian countries, there's another canon of books. Or in the Muslim countries, they have their books. But Veda doesn't mean that. That's not what the word Veda means. The word Veda means knowledge. So, this literature, Vedic literature, is actually scientific literature, which covers all areas of knowledge. which a human being requires to live in this world, to fulfill his desires. And this knowledge, it goes up, all the way up, to the subject matter of the Supreme Absolute Truth, who is the source of everything. And in particular, that knowledge is lacking. There are two, we should understand that there are two kinds of knowledge, or we can even say there are three. But one is not actually knowledge, but anyway, I'll explain. So there are three, we can say, departments of knowledge or kinds of knowledge visible in the human world. So the topmost is called para vidya. And that means knowledge of Krishna, knowledge of God. That knowledge which particularly pertains to God's name, form, quality, pastimes, activities. Then there is aparavidya, which is also presented in the Vedic literatures. And that's knowledge about this world. And the two things are related, para and apara, in that this world emanates from Krishna. And as I said, there's logic behind it. In other words, there is a plan for this world. Krishna has an intention for creating this universe, creating all the species of life. And that intention is given in the Vedic scriptures. So aparavidya and paravidya, the relationship between the two is like substance and shadow, or gold and paper money. This is a good example. That we have paper money. So what is that? You see, it's just paper, bits of paper. Why does it have value? It has value because the government has printed this paper and has backed it up with a reserve of gold. And the gold is the substance. The gold is the actual valuable substance. The paper represents the gold. And so you can use this paper, because the government recognizes it, therefore you can walk into a store with a piece of paper and you can buy all kinds of goods, walk out with two big shopping bags. And what did you give the person? A piece of paper. But it wasn't like, you know, taking newspaper and ripping off a piece and then handing it to them at the cash register. Here, you want some paper, here. They won't accept that, because it's not approved, it's not recognized by the government, it's not backed up. So the Vedic civilization, just like what we're reading about here, this is called Instructions for Civilized Human Beings. These instructions by Prahlad Maharaj. So you see here it's about Shraddha ceremony, it's about diet, it's about worship of demigods, it's about the varnas, it's about the ashrams. And when we read this verse after verse after verse, sometimes we think, well, you know, so what is this? We want to hear about Krishna, and this is all about the ancient Vedic culture. How relevant is it to us? But we should understand, this is the aparavidya. This is the shadow, the shadow of the substance being Krishna, the spiritual world. So in this world, this is what people should follow, the values, you can say this way, the values which extend from Krishna into this world to help people come back to Krishna, take full shelter of Him, become happy in all respects, and at the end go back home, back to Godhead. Because we're in this world. We're in this world, so we have to know what to do, how to live in this world. So that is the subject matter of aparavidya. So aparavidya, if this knowledge, these points that Narada Muni is explaining in this verse, if it is followed with the purpose for satisfying Krishna, then that aparavidya is as good as the paravidya. You know, just like, again, money is as good as gold if you use it lawfully. That's the government is printing money to give everyone a chance to participate in the economy. But the condition is it should be done lawfully. You should earn your money honestly. You should spend it honestly. So if someone cheats, if someone is a cheater, a thief or something, a criminal, and he amasses money illegally, let's say he has a big bank account full of lots of money, but he's earned it all illegally, and he's using it furthermore in all kinds of other illegal activities. He's using that money to promote in the society gambling and prostitution and intoxication and things like that. All illegal business. So what will the government do? You see? Will the government just sit by and say, well, he's got the money and we printed the money. I mean, you know, the money is good, so just what can we say? No. The government sees this money is being used wrongly, then they nullify the value of the money. You see? He may have, you know, 25 million kroner. I guess that's a lot of money. 25 million kroner in his bank account. But if the government just says, this money is worth nothing, they refuse to recognize it, then the man is helpless. And that's what government does. Someone who's illegal, they'll take over his bank account, seize the funds, they'll nullify all his business transactions, and he'll be put in jail. So it's like that with the Vedic knowledge also. As long as it is practiced for Krishna's purpose, then even this aparavidya, all this what we're reading about Shraddha ceremonies and how a father should give away his daughter for marriage and this and that, and what, you know, how brahmanas should collect their food and so on and so forth, all these different details, it's all part and parcel of Krishna consciousness, if it is all done to satisfy Krishna. If not, and that possibility is there too, that people follow the Vedic culture for their own ends, their own selfish purposes, then it is illegal. It is not recognized by Krishna. It becomes Maya, Vedic Maya, if Krishna is not the goal. So, all right, so we've described now two kinds of knowledge, paravidya and aparavidya. And then there is a third, which is not knowledge at all. It is actually avidya. Vidya means knowledge. Avidya means no knowledge, ignorance. And that is the knowledge as we see today. How to raise cows in big herds and make them very quickly fat and kill them. How to butcher them. How to separate all the parts of the body and prepare it in different ways. And then there's some cookbook, how to cook meat, very nice different preparations. And then how to prepare intoxicants, how to brew up beer and wine and whiskey, and how to mix drinks. You go to a bookshop, you'll see such books. How to mix drinks. And so many other things. How to enjoy sex life in so many different illicit ways. And so this is also so many volumes of books are published every year on this kind of stuff. And this is all called avidya. It's all ignorance, complete ignorance. And so, as Tilakanath Prabhu, he's always talking about, we have to take over. So when we take over, that will be stopped, right? Immediately, okay. Yes. Because avidya, it cannot be connected with Krishna. There is a connection in the sense that it is a demonstration of exactly what we should not do in this human form of life. Even these things you can learn from in that sense. When you see some, you know, intoxicated, crazy person lurching through the street, you see, talking all nonsense to himself. Sometimes you see such kind of characters. And then you can learn from, they also become your guru in that sense. You can thank Krishna that you didn't end up like that. So, In human civilization, that business, avidya, is not supposed to flourish. The government, the leaders, brahmanas and kshatriyas, they have solemn responsibility to suppress this, to actually suppress this. And Srila Prabhupada said, Trivikram Maharaj told me, he's heard Prabhupada say, talk about this, that if Krishna consciousness comes to government power, then there will not be, of course everyone said, is so, respectful of the principle of freedom of speech. This is supposed to be a very important principle in modern society, that you can say whatever the hell you want, and you can print books on whatever the hell you want, and distribute them to the society. And Srila Prabhupada said, no, there will be no such kind of freedom of speech, that any nonsense, paranoid, schizophrenic intellectual can publish in his insane ravings about what is the goal of human life. You see, that won't be allowed. Because why? Because, as Prabhupada said, the vast majority of people, 90% of the people in this world, are, they're innocent people. Innocent means they can be led either way. They can be led in the right direction or wrong direction. They're not very profoundly thinking people. And even, we must admit, this is even true of ISKCON. You see, the majority of devotees in ISKCON, we see, they're innocent, they're nice, they're pious, they have good hearts, but not always so bright. And they get misled. And we even see this in ISKCON, which is actually a society of the most intelligent people. That's a fact. Most intelligent people in the world are members of this movement, because those are the people who actually are thinking deeply enough about the purpose of life to want to accept a life of austerity and penance to achieve the supreme goal. This is the sign of the greatest intelligence. But even so, philosophically, devotees are generally simple. So, therefore, those who are endowed by Krishna with the philosophical departments in the brain and the administrative departments, brahmanas and kshatriyas, those who have those kind of compartments in their brain, they have a solemn duty to protect the simple pious souls. And Prabhupada said 90%, even today, 90% of our population, even in this hellish Kali Yuga, even where everything is inundated by sin, but 90% of the people are innocent. And 10% are demons. So demon, maybe I explained before, demon is a sociopath or a psychopath. It's a certain kind of distorted, twisted personality. It's been analyzed in the modern languages. They use these terms, sociopath or psychopath. So probably everyone's heard of the term psychopath. We think of it as meaning some kind of madman. But actually, technically, the definition is not... A psychopath is not a raving maniac, who comes running down the street with a big axe in his hand screaming, "Ah, I'll kill you." That's something else. They have their own, some other psychiatric terms for people like that. But a psychopath is a person who is outwardly very normal. Outwardly, he appears to be a normal individual working within society. You can't immediately detect that there's anything wrong with him. He's completely articulate. He speaks. He can think. He can hold down a very good job. He can even run a whole country. He can be a leader in charge of a country. But he's twisted. He's twisted up here in a certain way, that he thinks that he is the only one who knows what's right. And everybody else has to learn from him the hard way. It's good. He actually thinks it's good for other people to suffer under his rule. And he does, actually, he doesn't even recognize that they're suffering. His idea is that I have to teach them a lesson. You see, they're misguided. They don't understand. So I have to teach them a lesson. And he has, you know, he teaches them a real lesson. He torments them psychologically and physically. But he's actually thinking that it's good. He can never recognize what he's doing to other people. It's just not possible for him to understand because he has such a big false ego. And some of the famous psychopaths in recent history were people like Stalin and Hitler. That's how they're analyzed. Psychopaths. So, there's psychopaths everywhere in the world today. So-called normal people. But actually, we would call them demons. And it's just another word. We use this word demon. It means they're under the influence of demons. They're human beings, but their intelligence is controlled by demons. And that is the only explanation for why they act as they do. So these demons, they're in society, in the Kali Yuga, they become powerful. They become the leaders. They become the rulers. And they wreck everything. They just thwart, they derail the whole progressive direction of human civilization. It's a different logic. They're very intelligent, they have logic, but their logic is going in the wrong direction, not to Krishna, but away from Krishna. That's a demon. So Srila Prabhupada said, these demons have to be stopped. The purpose of this Krishna consciousness movement is to stop these demons. And modern society, it has values. Values have been introduced into modern society which are demoniac values. One is, for instance, freedom of speech. Of course, in an actually civilized society, Brahminical society, there is also freedom of speech for those who are learned in Vedic knowledge, for those who are giving the right conclusion. When everyone is educated properly, then there's also freedom of speech. This is what brahmanas are meant to do in society. Brahmanas especially are meant to speak. That is their occupation. Speak. Wherever they go, people are asking them, please speak. Please speak to us. So there's certainly freedom of speech. But it's freedom of transcendental speech. But in today's society, any crazy person is given the right to speech, is given the right to publish books and magazines. And then these go throughout society, innocent people read them, and they become crazy too. So this has to be stopped. So the logic behind all this is that people should not fall down into avidya, ignorance which is disguised as knowledge, total ignorance, total sinful activities. They should not fall into avidya. Rather, they should be brought up to the aparavidya, the Vedic material civilization, Vedic material culture, and from there they should be brought up to paravidya, the transcendental culture, Krishna consciousness. So that is the logic, I said, anvikshi. This is the term for Vedic logic, the Vedic plan of things. There's a verse in Bhagavatam which says that Lord Brahma studied the Vedic scriptures three times and anvikshaya, he came to this conclusion by logic, by studying the plan behind the Vedas. He came to this conclusion that the purpose of all the Vedic literature is to increase everyone's attraction to Krishna. That is the actual goal of all of these instructions, to help us in different ways, direct and indirect ways, to become more and more attracted to Krishna. Any questions? Yes.
I've been reading the capital of Srimad Bhagavatam. Yes.
Because it's a different, completely different process of knowledge. Scientific knowledge is ascending knowledge. Scientific knowledge is based on the false ego. I was explaining the other day that from out of the false ego, our sensory and mental functions arise. And false ego is what? False ego is it is, when we speak of ignorance, the mode of ignorance, that is the false ego. Ahamkara. That is the ignorance which separates the soul from the spiritual world, from the transcendental realm. It starts there. Actually, the first form of this ignorance is the thought that I am God. I am one with God. This impersonal Brahman. This is where false ego begins. And then it ends with our having material mind and senses, and it ends with the perceptions of this world. So that is what the scientists work with. The scientists think that knowledge means pratyaksha and anumana. Pratyaksha means exploration of the senses, the world of the senses, and anuman means mental speculation. So that is their method of knowledge. Whereas Vedic knowledge is handed down from the transcendental platform. So that is why the two descriptions of the universe are so different, because the process of knowledge is so completely different. There is a certain level in which pratyaksha and anuman correspond to the description of the Vedic scriptures. That's on the laukika. It's called laukika again, the ordinary level. You see, ordinary level of our perceptions, what we consider to be reality around us, that which we see immediately. So the Vedic description of things corresponds to that. But when you get into metaphysics, metaphysics means beyond what we can see with these senses, that's when the difference between the two processes of knowledge becomes greater and greater and greater and greater. Because the scientists, their senses are limited, you see. Their senses reach a limit, and then they try to go beyond that limit of their senses by mental speculation. Huh? They don't understand what they're seeing with their senses to begin with. Like when they look out across the universe, you know, and they see things out there, they don't know what they are. You see, they see these lights out there, and they call some of them stars, and they call some of them quasars, and neutron stars, and this and that, and nebula, and blah blah blah, galaxies, blah blah blah. They have all these terms, but they don't actually know what they give it a name, and they sound very confident. This is this, and this is that. But they don't actually know what that is. They're speculating, they're seeing something, and then they're guessing, and they formulate some theory to explain it all. Just like recently, it's very interesting. Recently it's been announced through the world's press that they have finally discovered planets around other star systems. I don't know if you've heard about this, but they're very excited now that we have finally discovered that in other star systems there are planets circling around. Now, I don't want to talk about the Vedic correspondence of this. All I want to say is that they haven't seen the planets. They haven't seen them, not even in their telescopes. They haven't seen them. But they see that the stars are wobbling in a certain way. And then this to them means that there must be a planet going around it. And then they say, we've discovered a planet. They haven't seen any planet. They just speculate that. They see something happening, and then they speculate. That means there's a planet there. That's how the science works. And then they have their propaganda machine which publicizes, scientists have today discovered planets around such and such. as if they've, you know, maybe even gone there in a spaceship and looked at it. But they haven't even seen it. So much of modern cosmology, the modern description of the universe, is like that. You see, they present it to you in a book as if you know, they have it all nailed down. It's all very clear. It's not clear. It's just mainly speculation. They see some you know, dots and lights and things out there, and then they bring it all together in some form, some scheme by mental speculation. Another example is there is a the big new theory in modern science is called the superstring theory. It's very, very new theory. It's only been around for 10, 15 years, and only in the last couple years has it become very, very big. There were just a few crackpots working on this theory for so many years, and just recently, in the last couple years, it's become all the rage. And the superstring theory is, you know, now the hot item within the last couple years. So the superstring theory is an attempt it's called the TOE, theory of everything, because one of the big problems in modern science is in modern physics is that they have competing theories, or we should say incompatible theories that explain different aspects of the universe, and these theories don't fit together. One of them is called classical physics. That's the physics of Sir Isaac Newton, which explains, you know, if I throw this up in the air, what happens to it? So it explains the dynamics of physical action on our level. And then there's the theory of relativity of Albert Einstein. So that's explaining things in a different way, including the factor of time and space and things like that, which were not included in, not so well understood by Newton. So then there's Einstein's theory of relativity, which is very different. It explains the world in a completely different way than Newton's theory. Two different worlds are being described by these two theories. They don't go together. They don't go together. Yet both work, and scientists use both of them. And then there's a third theory, the quantum physics, which is about the movements of the subatomic particles, protons and neutrons and photons and things like that. And that's a third, you know, like a third universe, you know. And they don't connect. These three don't connect together. And yet all three are used in science. So that's always been a problem. The scientists are always very unhappy about this, you know, that there's practically like a whole different description of reality for the different levels of our of what they want to do. You know, if they want to work in our common physical reality, which we all understand together, then they use Newton's. If they want to talk about, especially astrophysical, you know, out in outer space and things like that, then they use Einstein's theory. And if they want to talk about what's happening on the atomic level, then they use quantum theory. And they don't match together. They explain the world in completely different ways. You know, they're not coherent. So this superstring theory is the TOE, the theory of everything. It tries to explain all of them, bring them all together, and make one description, common description, which includes everything. So the superstring theory is a speculation that the universe is ultimately made up of strings of, you know, really microcosmic energy. What they say is like this. You know there's this solar system, the Sun and Mercury, Mars, Venus, Mercury, Venus, Earth, Mars, Jupiter, so these planets. And they have this depiction you know, with the circles going around, huge, huge solar system. And then sometimes they describe the atom in a similar way, right? There's a central nucleus, and around it there are the electrons also turning. So I recently read that the size of a superstring is like this. You can compare the solar system to the size of an atom, right? They look similar, but the size difference is so incredibly great. So then they say, take the atom and imagine it on the scale of a solar system. And then compared to that, something so small as an atom in comparison to that. And there you have a superstring. You understand what I'm saying? So a superstring is as small compared to an atom as an atom is compared to the universe, to the solar system. And so they say that, you know, the universe is ultimately made up of these superstrings, and they also exist in 10 dimensions. They exist in 10 dimensions. We only can experience, if you include time, 4 dimensions, but they're talking about 10 dimensions. And they have, you know, they're doing all kinds of mathematics, and they're and presenting this theory of superstrings. But there's absolutely, you know, so it's becoming accepted now. But the thing is, there's absolutely no proof that superstrings exist whatsoever. There's no proof whatsoever. It's just an idea. It's just a theory. They say, you know, there's these big machines they build. They're called cyclotrons. They have one in Switzerland. Atom smashers, you know, these big circular machines they build. They're huge now. They used to just build them small enough to be in a laboratory, but now, in order to find out about little particles, they have to build these things which have a circular radius, you know, a circumference of, you know, miles around. So they have a big one in Switzerland near Lake Geneva. And then they it's all like a magnetic tube, and they rush particles around it. Faster and faster and faster, and then they smash them together. Some particles going in this direction, some particles going in that direction, and they meet and they smash, and they have all kinds of instruments which then figures out what happens, you know, when the little particles smash together and energies are released, and then their knowledge increases, they think. So then they what they find out when they do this is they find out about smaller particles. That's how their knowledge increases. They're sending small particles around, right? And they smash them together, and then they break up into smaller particles, and then they can find out smaller particles and give them names. You know, that's science today. And then you could say, oh, here's a new particle. Let's call it. They have one they call smile, and there's another one they call charm, and another one they call quark. So they give them these funny names, and then they think their knowledge is increasing. So. So these superstrings, you know, the thing is they make these cyclotrons so big because they have to build up so much speed. You know, it's like a train, right? You know, a big train at the station. You know, when it doesn't start off going like this. You know, it starts off slow and goes faster and faster. So they're the same thing with these little particles. They have to have, you know, enough of a distance to get going really, really fast. And then when they collide, you know, at a great speed, then they break up very nicely. And so in order for, they've calculated, in order to actually be able to detect if these superstrings actually exist, because it's just a theory, and the only way they could test it is by smashing particles together at a huge speed. And in order to reach that speed, they would have to build a cyclotron, this circular track, they say, as it would be as big a circle as the orbit of the planet Pluto around the sun, which is the 9th planet in our solar system. So they'll never build such a cyclotron. And so they have no way of proving at any time that these superstrings exist. And yet, this is the big, hot, new theory. And if you want to really become famous in science today, then you should get into superstrings. This is the kind of thing that's being said now. It's just complete mental speculation. But the thing is, then they publish all these books and very confidently tell people, we know that this universe is ultimately made up of superstrings. And then, and then people read and go, wow, these scientists, boy, they're really intelligent. And, you know, and then they imagine the universe to be just what the scientists are saying. And then they ask this question in the class, but why is it that what the Bhagavatam says and what the science says is so different? And the answer is, because the scientists are just speculating their brains all over the wall. In other words, you know, you could also go to the loony bin, you know, the psychiatric institute, and go down in the cellar where they keep their really, really crazy patients behind the big doors, and you could go there and you could talk with them and ask them how they understand the universe. And you'd also get a real different description than what you find in Fifth Canto of Srimad Bhagavatam. That's actually the main difference, you see. It's just someone is speculating. But the scientists, they're getting away with it. Instead of being locked up in the basement of the psychiatric institute, they're in some scientific institute. And they're big, big, important people. Huh? Yeah, big salaries and big influence in society. But they actually belong in the basement of the psychiatric institute, locked up behind big, thick doors. Because they're dangerous persons. They're making everyone crazy. Not only are they speculating like madmen, but they're making everybody else speculate in the same way. That's why the whole world is becoming more crazy. Yes. Oh yeah, directly. Well, it's the fact that there's so much cheating and politics. It's a very nasty business, the scientific world. It's just a bunch of karmis. You see, that's what you got to understand. The scientists are not demigods. They're just a bunch of karmis. And so all of their private life is scandalous. Their relationships with one another is all full of backstabbing and cheating and enviousness. In the academic world, academic world in general, the main dynamic, you know, dynamic means the main force, which is making all these big intellectual scholars, whether they're scientists or, you know, historians or philosophers, but the main force that is making them do whatever they do is enviousness. That's a fact. That's well understood. They're completely envious of one another. And they have a saying in the academic world that would but my enemy publish a book. Which means, you know, that they're just waiting for another scholar to publish a book so that they can all get on it and tear it apart. And then publish all kinds of, you know, criticisms. And this person doesn't know what he's talking about at all. This is all ridiculous. See, on this page he says this. This is nonsense. And on that page he says this is nonsense. And that's what it's all about. That the whole enterprise of modern academia is based on this. You publish a book to make a name for yourself, and then you've got a pack of envious scholars around you ripping your book to pieces to prove to everyone that you don't know what you're talking about. You're no better than the rest of us. And then someone else will publish a book criticizing your book, and that will be ripped apart. You see, so it goes on and on like that. Like a pack of dogs, you know, biting one another.